Today's podcast is brought to you by Mass Street Music. For decades, Mass Street Music's founder, Jim Baggett, has been one of the world's leading authorities when it comes to vintage and new guitars. You've probably seen him on the Antiques Roadshow. He's one of the main appraisers on that TV show. He's also been at the Fretboard Summit. He is literally everywhere. He runs an incredible store in Lawrence, Kansas that's filled with great boutique makers like Collings, Anderson, Don Grosch, and others. He now has Milkman Amps. I usually keep an eye out for weird vintage instruments, obscure instruments, hard-to-find instruments when I look at a dealer's website. But what caught my eye when I went to massstreetmusic.com today was this absolutely gorgeous new Collings MTGT mandolin in honey amber. Those mandolins are so great. The design is so simple. It's one of the lower-priced Collings mandolins available, yet it is just a work of art and a beautiful instrument. Head on over to massstreetmusic.com if you want to check that out or reach out to Jim and his staff. I know they will treat you right, whether you need to buy something, have a guitar restored, or have a setup, or just have a simple guitar question. And if you do reach out to them, by all means, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you so they know that these plugs work. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. We have some big news for you, but before we get to that, I just want to say to all of you guys that, like many of you, I was absolutely crushed to hear that Anthony Bourdain took his life this morning. The news came out. We don't talk about food. We don't talk to chefs usually on the Fretboard Journal podcast, but guys like Anthony Bourdain are such stellar storytellers, and at the end of the day, that is what I care about. That is why I do the magazine, and I do the podcast, and I do all of these projects where we go out and we interview people in the field about their craft and their music, and I kind of always felt like Bourdain was a kindred spirit to all of that, as well as a huge inspiration with everything he did. So as musicians, as guitar people, we tend to be a sensitive lot. Needless to say, if you are having mixed feelings about the world or you just need some support, please reach out to loved ones and do what you can, and I will do what I can as well. All right, on to somewhat cheerier news. I do have some big news for you guys. The first installment of this big news is the Fretboard Journal 42 is mailing to all of you subscribers right now. You should be seeing it over the next 7 to 10 days, depending on where you live. Some of you guys who live way out in other countries, it might take a little longer. But it is mailing to you right now. It is a great issue. I don't want to spill the beans on everything that's in there, but we have a fun and insightful conversation between Mark Stepman of Folkway Music and the legendary luthier T.J. Thompson talking about guitar restoration and how some builders get it right and some builders get it not so right. It was pretty insightful for me to read. We've got the amazing young supergroup I'm With Her in this issue. I went out and I also interviewed Andy Powers of Taylor Guitars, who is a true tour de force. And there's, 90 pages of other content that I'll leave as a surprise for you guys. But it's on its way. If you have not subscribed to the Fretboard Journal yet, you should do so. And you can do it a couple of different ways. You can order the single issue on our website just by going to the shop tab. But we also, for the next week, are having a Father's Day special where for $49.95, you can get the new issue of the Fretboard Journal as well as the next 4 issues of the Fretboard Journal. So you'll get 5 issues for less than $10 a piece mailed to your door. It's one of the best offers we've ever done. It's our Father's Day special, and you just go to the shop tab at Fretboard Journal, and you will see it there, you should do it. And we will, for anyone who's listening to this, who's dad, or maybe you just want to treat yourself to a Father's Day gift, if you place those orders by Wednesday, June, I'm looking at the calendar, I guess it's June 13th, we will get you the Fretboard Journal 42 before Father's Day. We're going to mail everything out via priority mail. So that's the big news, installment number one. The big news, installment number two, is that we are definitely committed now to doing the Fretboard Journal's first ever electric annual. This is an entire edition of the Fretboard Journal in a new format all around the world of electric guitars, electric guitar makers, icons, musicians. We have been busy interviewing a ton of folks, some of whom are on your radar and some of whom probably aren't. We've got some of our favorite people from the last 13 years of publishing. I'm looking at you, Bill Frisell and Ry Cooter, in all new interviews in this issue, and a lot more. This is going to be packaged with the same sort of keepsake quality that we are known for in limited advertising, but it is an entirely new thing. It's not the Fretboard Journal 43. It is its own thing. So you can order that now by clicking the shop tab at fretboardjournal.com and checking that out. So I hope you guys order it. You will not get it if you are a subscriber. You have to order it separately because I know about half of our subscribers want nothing to do with the world of electric guitars, and I don't want to piss you guys off. So there's that. But I'm really excited about how it's all coming together, and it's fun having done the Fretboard Journal now for 13 years to really kind of dig deep and do something slightly different, although we're still snobs about aesthetics and design and who we put in there. Also, in case there are any manufacturers or companies, large or small, listening to this podcast who may want to advertise on the electric issue, you can reach out to me at jason@fretboardjournal.com, and we could talk to you about it. The time is kind of running out. We're going to mail this thing in early August, so we're kind of in the middle of production right now. But I'm not going to turn down any support from anybody who may want to help us out with this endeavor and get promoted. All right, today's podcast, finally, is an interview that I did with the musician Todd Albright, who you may not know about, but has a fascinating story. He came in here, you know, a lot of musicians, when you read their press bio, it calls them a troubadour, but I would say Todd is definitely the fitting image of a troubadour. He came in, he had the suit on, he has two 12-string guitars. This guy does not even play a 6-string guitar, and he is just channeling country blues and Delta blues like you have never heard before. We have a video with him that will be going live over the next week or so, but check out his music. He's on Third Man Records. He's from Detroit. We talk about the story of how Jack White sort of discovered him, and Todd came in with a suit. He had his own chair. He had his own brick for his foot to rest on, and he had these two amazing Fralini guitars built by Todd Cambio, including the one that is a recreation of Lydia Mendoza's 12-string guitar. And I just knew immediately when he came in the door and we started talking, like, this guy's got some stories to tell, and he is the real deal. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. As always, if you do enjoy the Fretboard Journal podcast, one of the easiest and fastest ways to support us is just by going onto iTunes and giving us a star rating and leaving us a quick little review. It takes about 20 seconds of your time, and it definitely helps us out with our search rankings. And that's all I got for you guys. Here is our conversation with Todd Albright. I do hope you enjoy it. Todd, thanks for coming to the Fretboard Journal.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you've got two 12-string Fralini guitars here.
I do.
Are they exactly the same aside from the tuning?
No, they're completely different. This one here is a copy of a Tonk Brothers 12-string from the 20s. There's a picture on that guitar right there of Blind Willie McTell.
Yeah.
I think that's the one, is it?
No.
Okay.
That's him playing the Tonk.
Yeah.
Which is a copy.
And the deal is the Tonk, we've only got that picture, and we've got one actual example of the Tonk 12-string that was owned by Paul Jeremiah, and Paul sold it to Todd Cambio.
Yeah.
And that's, the specs came off of that to build this all the way down. I mean, it's exactly that guitar, from the shape of the neck to this beautiful inlay. The whole thing is, the purfling, it's incredible. The saddle and the nut and the fret markers are mule bone.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the other guitar?
The other guitar, that's walnut. Walnut and obviously a spruce top. And it was based on the guitars that were made by the Acosta family in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
The folks that made Lydia Mendoza's guitar. So it's similar to that in some degree, but they're both, you know, jumbo guitars. They're both, this is a 27-inch scale here, the Tonk Brothers guitar, and the other here is 26.5, which was pretty standard for these baritone style 12 strings.
So how did you get into this style of music?
I drew the unlucky number, you know. Why couldn't I have been a pop star? I don't know.
Is this like a ghost world thing?
Yeah. Yeah, bad luck, I guess, is what got me to it. No, when I was a kid, I learned a couple of chords from my mom's cousin who was into like old Hank Williams and things like that. And he showed me the first couple of chords. I mean, he played hillbilly music, you know. And from there, I was just on my own. And as soon as I heard a finger-picked guitar, that was it for me. You know, that was, I would listen to anything that was fingerstyle, whether it was, I don't care if it was John Denver or Jim Croce to what. It didn't matter. If it was finger-picked, I wanted to hear it, and I wanted to know how to do that, you know. And the blues, obviously, I mean, in the early days of guitar, I mean, people finger-picked. That was the common way to play the guitar, playing with a pick or wasn't as prominent. People played with their fingers, you know, and that especially during the parlor guitar thing of the 1800s when ladies were picking those beautiful little parlor guitars. I mean, they were, you know, tuned to an open chord and they were playing finger style. You know, that was just the natural way to play a guitar. And obviously the, you know, the early country blues, that's all finger style guitar.
Yeah.
You know, every bit of it's, they're finger picked. And I don't know, when you hear a sound and it gets you like that, it won't let you go, and that's, you become, it's good when you're young, when you're a kid, 12, 13 years old, and you hear that, and you're allowed to indulge your obsessive compulsive behaviors because you got nothing else going on in the world.
Yeah.
You're not paying bills. You're just a kid. So you can sit there in your room forever and nobody cares.
Yeah.
You know, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, as a grown-up, it gets...
It gets tough.
It gets tougher.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so where did you grow up again? Detroit?
I grew up in Toledo, Ohio, which is about 40 minutes south of Detroit.
Yeah.
And you know how it goes. It's like everybody migrates to the next largest city. Had Cleveland been 20 minutes closer, you never know. You know? The record could be called, you know, Cleveland 12 string.
So did you have a mentor in the guitar world? Teachers? Or?
You know, not for a long time. It was mostly just like... You know, I'd find weird records, like, at the library. Like, the first real record that did me was Dave Van Ronk's Inside Dave Van Ronk.
Mm-hmm.
I found the LP at the public library. And those songs on that record, and it was finger-picked, and it was this gigantic person, you know. And I had no thought that he could possibly still be alive,
yeah.
You know. And then I'm thumbing through the local... paper, and there I see this Dave Van Ronk is playing in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. You know, blew my mind. So I think I was 16 at that point, and I had a driver's license. I know that. And I went to that show and I met Dave, and it was absolutely incredible. And it was a double bill with, it was him and Spider John Kerner.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was just, I mean, mind blowing for a 16-year-old fingerstyle guitar freak. It was the greatest thing you could ever see, you know? And then the next thing you know, within a couple of weeks of that, I was at another record store and I found this new release, and it was The Gamblin' Woman Blues by Paul Jeremiah. And I didn't know who he was, and I'm looking at the back, and he's got songs like Cocaine Princess, and he's doing Peg Leg Howl numbers and all this shit. And I'm like, and the cover is this beautiful painting of this guy with a mustache playing a 12-string, playing this 12-string, actually.
Uh-huh.
And he's got a deck of cards like shooting out of the sound hole, and it's this wild, incredible painting, you know, which I find out later was done by Eric Von Schmidt, the great folk blues guitar guy, you know. And I bought that record just on the strength of the cover, you know, and I took it home, and there was this sound that I couldn't believe. And it was like, you know, I was familiar with Lead Belly and I was familiar with Blind Willie McTell, but then I'm hearing something that was modern. It was a contemporary sounding 12 string, you know. And it was Paul doing this, it was Skin Game Blues by Peg Leg Howell. And I'm like, how in the hell is his guitar sounding? You know, because I bought a 12 string almost, you know, the same year I started playing guitar because I loved the sound of it. But I'm wondering, why the hell does my guitar not sound anything like his guitar? Well, turns out I'm playing a piece of junk with light gauge strings that are cranked up to full tension. You know, I had no idea about long scale 12 strings and, you know, heavy gauge strings and tuning low, you know, these are all tuned down to, you know, that's A, you know, it's tuned low. And I remember watching that there's little clips of Lead Belly, you know, that they have, you know, this color thing he's doing, Pick a Bale of Cotton and the Gray Goose. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? I'm watching the chord. He's making, that's a G chord. I know that's a G chord, but it sounds nothing like my guitar. I'm playing that same chord. What the hell is it? And then of course, I was changing the strings on the guitar and I didn't tune it properly.
Yeah.
And suddenly it sounds like Paul Jeremiah's guitar. And I was like, wait a minute. I was that dumb.
Yeah. No. These are important moments.
Oh, it was an epiphany completely. I was like, holy shit, this is how it works. This is how it's low tuned. It's incredible, yeah. You know? And, after that, I noticed in that same paper, there's Paul Jeremiah playing at the Ark. I'm like, God, I got to go. So I went, and it was a funny story. The place was packed. It was full. You know, he could really command an audience in those days. And no Paul. Everybody's waiting. People are getting weird and smoking and, because you could smoke indoors back then.
Yeah, of course.
And no Paul. And finally, the lady that was running the show came out and said, we're really sorry. He's on his way. He's running late. He fell asleep in his hotel. And sure enough, about 5 minutes later, Paul comes in and his face is covered with like pillow marks, the wrinkles from his hair was all tousled up and he was really grumpy. And he sat there with his tuning his, he didn't even acknowledge the audience at all. He's tuning his guitars and he just looked up and says, what do you want to hear? And it was almost like a threat, And he sat there and played Request for almost 2 hours. And and that was the first time I actually saw a 12 string guitar played properly.
Yeah.
Because most guys, I'm sorry, Roger McGuinn, I'm sorry, you're not doing it right. A lot of folks love you.
Yeah.
But as far as playing a 12 string, it's a whole different beast. You can't play it like a six string.
Yeah.
So
do you even play six string?
I don't even own one.
You don't even own one?
No.
That's amazing.
It's been several years since I've owned one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, before stumbling into the work of Todd's guitars, which are rather pricey.
Yeah.
Like, what were you using as a 12 string to kind of just get by before you discovered
these? They were all varieties of junk, whatever I could find. Fender 12 strings.
Yeah.
Sorry, Fender. Not a great guitar you were making there, you know. Stay to the electrics and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
And they were short scale.
Yeah.
And you can't do nothing with that.
Yeah.
You end up sounding like, Roger McGuinn.
Yeah.
Right.
So it sounds like you're largely pretty much self-taught.
For the most part. But, in later years when Paul and I had become friends, I would sit him down and he would show me once.
Yeah.
He would show me once. And if I didn't get it, that was just too bad, Jim. That's all you're getting is... you're getting it once. But I learned so much about, what string gauges are, how to do this, how to set the things up, because they don't stay in tune ever,
Even the good ones?
No, you can't. It's not a function of the guitar. They don't stay in tune and you have to just accept that, Nobody makes great tuners for them anyway,
Yeah.
They're hard to come by. There are companies that are trying, but there's been no real,
Yeah.
What can you do?
It's a small market.
It is. Nobody cares. Nobody. Yeah. Was there four of us that we were even interested in them?
So what got you to Detroit?
Bad luck. That's the only reason anybody goes to Detroit. It was music. I'd been going there, since I had a driver's license to go to shows and to see music and to see, it was a hotbed of garage rock for years, But I was never a rock and roll person. I was never into it. But at a certain point, I remember Fat Possum did this, the record label did this Fat Possum review where they dug up all these old dudes. This was in the early 90s. And they, I don't know, logistically it sounds like a nightmare having 8 or 10 elderly bluesmen from, the sticks of Mississippi in a caravan going from venue to venue to state to state. It sounds like,
I remember this. Yeah.
It sounds crazy,
Ford and Arnold.
Yeah, T-Model Ford, Hassel Atkins.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that, yeah. Just to make it
guy.
Even crazier.
Just to make it, just to add a little fuel to the whole thing. And RL was there. I don't remember if Junior Kimbrough was there or not. I don't think he was, but it was the early 90s, and that was an exceptional show. Seeing those guys, because that really was RL was the guy that last learned from Fred McDowell. So he was the last real link. Since then, those guys are all gone. We don't have them anymore, and it's not like it was in during the folk revival of the 60s, where, you know, people like Paul and, like we talked about, Steve James earlier, those guys knew Skip James. They were, you know, Paul learned how to tune to the minor tuning from Skip James, you know. And it was important to, I mean, you know, Paul had a stroke a couple of years ago, so he's not what he used to be, you know, but I bother him regularly. You know, I visit often and call as much as I can, and I'm constantly asking him things about Yank Rachel, or, you know, just to see, you know, sometimes the memories are good, sometimes they're a little hazy, you know, but there's always something to, you know, be gleaned from talking to these guys.
Yeah. So you moved to Detroit to become a full-time musician?
Well, yeah, I think I had gotten tired. I was a tile installer.
Okay.
And there's a life expectancy.
It's pretty hard on your back.
Yeah, it's just tough. And I had been playing in Detroit quite a bit, and it got to the point where it's like, man, I am wasting so much gas money driving to Detroit. I should just live there finally. So I rented a room from for $100 a month. My friend Danny Croha, who's a guitar player in the band the Gories, which was the big garage rock outfit from the 80s and 90s. Anyway, he had bought the Gories did a reunion, and he did a little tour, and he saved up his pennies and he bought a house for $10,000. And I rented a room from him, and it was great. It was a lovely period of time, to because I didn't have to do anything but pay $100 a month, and I could play all the guitar, and I drove everybody nuts because I play you know, 8-9 hours a day.
Wow.
You know, if I'm at my leisure and I can do it, I'll play all day.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll play the same song all day. Yeah. I'll play the same lick all day. You know, it's that weird, I don't think you can become good at guitar unless you have some sort of mental illness. You know, to be able to sit and do the same damn thing for hours and days, you know, there has to be something wrong with you to do that. So, yeah, I mean, we moved to Detroit, and it was lovely, and the community at that point was very receptive to, you know, the garage rock thing was very influenced by John Lee Hooker and the blues, and it was heavy blues-based music. I mean, we had Motown there. We have, you know, Fortune Records, you know, all these great early rhythm and blues labels and all this great history. And because Detroit struggled for so long, it was a very affordable place to live, and a lot of great music came out of that period. I mean, you know, before the White Stripes, there was the Gories and all this and that, and then there was the White Stripes, and that whole thing happened. And it's changed now because Detroit is up and coming, as they say. So when things become up and coming, the artists have to go. That's the first people that leave are the artists. They can't stick around where the rent's too high, you know.
And that's already happening in Detroit?
Oh, it's becoming obnoxious, Yeah, it's
so
already.
Where's the next Detroit?
Flint. I don't know. As soon as they can figure out how to drink the water, we'll be all right in Flint.
So you mentioned the White Stripes, so you're on Third Man Records.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, Jack opened the headquarters for Third Man is in Nashville, Tennessee, and they have a little venue there, and the label offices are there, and then Jack wanted to open another place in Detroit, and the one in Nashville is very tiny. It's a small place. The one in Detroit is almost it's like a small shopping mall. It's huge. It's a massive showroom. It's huge. And in the back, they opened a factory, and it's a pressing plant, and he bought 5 brand spanking new vinyl record pressing machines, and he's got a factory that's, last count, I think he's got 50 full-time employees running 3 shifts around the clock, pressing records for whoever wants them, and it's an incredible operation. And so they opened that, and they also had this thing called Third Man Books. They have a book imprint now, and they were doing a reading with some of their authors, poetry, at the Third Man store in Detroit. It was kind of their, I think it was Third Man Books' 1-year anniversary or something like that, and they decided that instead of just having poets, they needed a palate cleanser between poets, and that's where I came in. And they, somebody I didn't know sent me an email saying, hey, would you be interested in playing at Third Man during this poetry review, blah, blah, blah. So I did that, and Jack was there, you know. And when I came off the stage, I was told that they would like to do a record. And then we did. And that's what happened.
It's that easy.
It's that stupid. Yeah, it's that easy. That's how it happens. I don't know how else it happens in the world, but that's what happened here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now,
it sounds like crap, doesn't it? Like that, like that's like shit you read about and it doesn't really happen.
No, it's a Cinderella story.
It is, yeah, but nobody believes that actually happens, but it does, it really does.
To a guy who brings his own brick to
games. I do, I bring my own brick.
Yeah. Is there a story behind the brick?
Well, it says it's got Athens, Ohio stamped on it.
Okay.
And I like to say that if the venue doesn't pay, when I drive past, when I leave, I can chuck it through their window.
For sure.
So it's a dual-purpose brick. I can set my foot on it when I play.
Yeah.
And I can, you know, throw it at would-be assailants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you...
Rowdy crowds,
you
things
that
like that.
Planes?
No, I haven't done that yet. I don't think they would mind.
No,
would they
wouldn't mind. No. It'd just be a pain in the butt to haul a brick around. But well, I guess you're used to it.
When you're a solo blues guy who travels alone, everything is a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... To, you know, you've got these amazing guitars by Todd Cambio, Fralini guitars, to kind of capture the sound of a 20s-ish era blues guitar, 12-string.
Yeah, oh yeah.
How, when you go into the studio to do your record, what kind of thought are you putting to microphones or engineering, or how are you, what sound are you chasing after there?
Well... I don't know it until I hear it. I don't, you know, I'll sit down and we'll record some things and we'll try to dial it into where the guitar sounds. I want it out front. I want it to be more robust than my vocals because I'm not the strongest singer in the world. That's just part of the deal.
Yeah.
You know, the guitar is the important part. So I want to make sure above all that that sounds great. The rest of it, I don't really care about, you know, and honestly, I'm not much of a recording nerd in any way. I don't really care what it, I mean, I care, of course, what it sounds like, but how it gets to that point, I have no idea. That's all I know how to do is play the guitar. So when it comes to, like, microphones and this and that, I know a lot of engineers can get super crazy about stuff like that. I just, once it's mixed, I'm like, either I like it or I don't, you know.
And when you're home woodshedding, how are you dividing your time between trying to figure out old songs versus, like, the newer material?
Well... I had thought recently that maybe I should buy a 6-string guitar.
Oh, no.
I know. Well, just because, you know, when you're listening, because a lot of these songs weren't originally done on a 12-string, some of them, you know. And trying to figure out, I'm tuned down to A here, and they're in standard or thereabout, you know, on a 6-string guitar. It's hard to figure out what they're doing on that scratchy old 78.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm thinking maybe I might... I might buy a 6-string just to help me figure out what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
But as far as what was the question?
Like your material, like what when you're at home working on new material.
Yeah.
Do you is it kind of like 50% of your time is working on new compositions and 50% is chasing these old blues tunes, or are you?
You know, I don't really write anything.
You don't?
Yeah. No, I don't really write anything. They're all. I mean, there's enough material out there that people don't know.
Yeah.
You know, that need it. My job is, I'm just a torchbearer. I'm here to keep this going.
Yeah.
You know, because if not, it will die. It will die out. There's no question about it. I mean, there'll be one or two other lunatics out there that are still going to, you know, continue playing this stuff, you know. And as long as people keep showing up to the gigs, and it seems so far in this tour they are, you know, I'm just going to keep going and playing these songs.
Yeah.
You know, they're important. It's like, last night I was talking about songs like Statesboro Blues, you know, and like, you know, the Allman Brothers did it, sort of.
Yeah.
You know, they did a version of it. But, I mean, they could have sang any lyrics over that music, and it wouldn't have mattered, you know. But to me, that song is almost like a classical piece. I wouldn't change a bit of it. You know, I try to play that one in particular as closely as I can to the way Willie did it. Of course, I can't. Nobody's going to play it like Willie did, you know, not exactly. But if you can get close, and if Willie McTell were to walk through the door, he would know it was his. That's what I strive for. I don't try to be, I'm not a guy that's trying to play exactly like the old guys were, but I want them, you know, if the dead rose and they walk through the door, Lead Belly would go, yeah, that's mine.
Yeah.
You know, and stop playing it. Yeah.
So, Blind Willie McTell is not a household name by any stretch, but amongst
guitarists. But he ought to be.
He ought to be, yeah. Guitarists know him. Who are you obsessing over right now that maybe folks wouldn't be on folks' radar?
There's a lot. You know, there were guys like George Carter. I played that Rise and River Blues. Yeah. He only did three songs, or four songs, but three of them sounded the same musically.
Yeah.
You know? Short career. He only did 2 78s and then kind of disappeared, and there's guys like, what was his name? I can't remember what the hell his name. There's a lot of these guys that just did one, like Seth Richards. They only did a couple of songs, and that was it. And you can only find them like weird, obscure document compilations and shit like that. It's like, I mean, I just love anything that's... I just love the 12-string guitar. Like Barbecue Bob is, you know, an incredible weirdo.
Yeah.
You know, his guitar had... they didn't have octave strings on it. They were all unison strings. And it was bizarre, and I think there was only maybe 10 strings on the guitar.
Yeah.
You know, just, it's so idiosyncratic, all those guys were, especially, I mean, and why did they all come from Georgia, all these 12-string players?
Yeah.
Why did they all come from Atlanta? What was going on that caused everybody and their mother to be a 12-string guitar player?
Yeah.
You know? Nobody knows.
Yeah.
Nobody knows.
Are you at a point in your career where you're starting to teach the youth of America how to play 12-string
players? Oh, I would love to, but nobody wants to know how. I would be totally into teaching, but nobody, they're not knocking down my door to figure out how to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul was Paul Jeremiah was the last guy that knew how to do this right.
Yeah.
With a 12-string guitar.
Yeah.
And I don't know anybody else that's actually doing it anymore. I don't know anybody that's actively playing. There's a couple guys here and there that play, but playing country blues on a 12-string guitar, like, in that fashion, I don't know of many.
Yeah.
You know.
It's a daunting instrument.
Yeah, and God help you if you fall in love with that sound, because then you're done. You know, how could you possibly play a 6-string?
Yeah.
Right.
So what's next for you, Todd?
Well, you mean this afternoon?
No, I mean in general, yeah.
In general? Well, I hope to make another record here pretty soon, and I'm just going to keep touring. I mean, that seems to be the way you... In order to survive as a... I can't express to you how happy I am to not be in a band.
Yeah.
Because the music business as it is so tough. I don't know how bands make it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how you do it.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess the object of the game is to stay on the road and stay out of jail and, you know, just keep going.
All right. Good luck with that.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.